So welcome. Yeah, Patricia was right. I've spent many years doing this. 20-some, I can't remember how many years ago, I was the landscaper at the Waldorf School down there. And the second week on the job, somebody, an arson, torched the administration building that held the library. And I was called down there by the fire department to shut the water off. I didn't even know where it was because I had just gotten the job. And so I was down there when the fireman left. And I went into the library and there was 1/8 of a shelf left in the library with about 30 books on it. And on one corner of that shelf was a copy of Paul Allen's Christian Rosenkreuz anthology. I'll bring it in tomorrow because it's just totally burnt on the outside and totally cool on the inside. And that was my introduction to The Alchemical Wedding, because Paul Allen was a remarkable anthroposophical scholar, knew 15 different languages, and traveled through the United States in the 50s as a traveling ambassador for anthroposophy in the States. Paul Allen, brilliant, brilliant man. And he was an alchemist and a scholar, and he translated The Alchemical Wedding into English. And then out of that, but he translated it, and then there is a kind of old English style to it out of the German. And because he was a scholar. And so when you actually read it, it makes absolutely no sense at all. And I thought that was really a shame, because the Alchemical Wedding is a document for contemporary initiation problems, which is inflation and skepticism, the two great polarities. So the darkness in the soul is inflation and skepticism. The healing is humility. So our theme that I'd like to pursue with you is the initiation process that's described in The Alchemical Wedding is the oscillation between humility and inflation. Inflation is the sin of our age. Inflation simply means you think you know more than you do, and you tell everybody else about it. This is called the blog sphere. So basically, inflation runs on opinion, my opinion, right or wrong. And the flip side of inflation, my opinion, right or wrong, is, well, my opinion says you're wrong and your opinion says I'm wrong, so we're both right about our opinions that we're both wrong, which is the rat chasing its tail. That's the snake biting its own tail. This is the cycle that we could call it the news cycle. And so the cycling of opinion is a masquerade or a kind of charade for actually learning something. And there's an old saying that the master is self-limiting. So the healing of opinion, the opinion sphere, that is the purpose of the opinion, is to make people get so exasperated with opinions that they stop wanting to get to truth. That's the hidden purpose. That you'll eventually get to a spot where you will not be able to say whether anything is anyone's opinion has any kind of truth behind it, and your moral capacity gets diminished. This is why skepticism and inflation rules in the realm of opinion as a preparation for what Rudolf Steiner calls mass psychosis, which is, I don't care what the truth is. Just let me have my little whatever bread and circuses of the Roman Empire, and I'll be happy. And you can do whatever you want because it's only an opinion anyway. So that's why I say this book is a document for contemporary souls. It's a document about the initiation process that a contemporary soul will have to go through, oscillating between inflation and skepticism, between thinking you know something and then finding out you don't, and then saying, well, I don't care anyway, I could say whatever I want. I don't care if it's true or not, I only care that a bunch of people won't listen to me saying it. This is the consciousness that preceded the Third Reich. Eventually, people gave up thinking there was something to understand. So we're in a contemporary consciousness. This book is about a person who went through an initiation that was for way in the future. It's a teaching from Christian Rosenkreutz about the questions of how, as a modern scientific consciousness, can I use skepticism in a constructive way, and how can I allow knowledge to come to me, and instead of inflating me, turn the knowledge into wisdom? How can I transform knowledge into wisdom without inflation? How can I survive skepticism by just saying, I'll hold off an opinion until I actually feel that I have something that I feel is true? It may not be true ultimately, but I can set things out for you, so at least we can have dialogue. So that's really what this book is about. And it's hidden, it's in a hidden kind of language. It's in a symbolic language of metaphor. I've spent most of my adult life swimming in metaphor. And this book, when I got it, through those circumstances, through the fire, I eventually have met Paul Allen's widow, lovely woman, she's an anthroposophical architect, and she allowed me, I stayed in her home when I was lecturing in Pennsylvania, and she allowed me to spend a day that I had free with Paul Allen's annotations of what he would do to change his translation of the Christian Rosenkreutz anthology. So that was a real treat for me to be able to talk to her about him and then have his handwritten notes about what he would like to do. So I felt that in bringing this work, I can stand for it as a document and say that I think it's a core in anthroposophy about an initiation practice for contemporary souls, although it's metaphorical. We could say it's symbolic. So in order to really understand it, we have to understand that there was a different worldview when it was written. It was actually, today we would say, channeled. That no one really knows who the real author was, because the person who wrote it down was in a trance consciousness. And then eventually it was a prelate, a a theologian, and eventually disowned it. So it came through funny doorways and came intact and ended up as this very strange document. But in order to understand it, it's useful to understand that it was coming out of a cultural context that was used to metaphor rather than, and I was used to the fact that symbolic language had a higher meaning. Today, when we use symbolic language, it's just presented as opinion. We don't understand that behind it is a higher world. We take everything just kind of face value and then try to bring it in context in a scientific skepticism, and if it proves wrong, then we just have the little minds beating on the little minds. But at this time, when it was written, it was understood that the language had two levels. It had the level of the empirical language of the thing itself, but it also had, behind the thing was a symbolic or metaphorical content. We had a conference here on the flaming door. It was about symbolic consciousness. That was kind of a preparation for this. Because symbolic consciousness is the healing of skepticism. If we learn to think in symbols, we will have a feeling of having what it could be called a collaborative will. And I'll go there later when we talk about collaborative will. Synergy comes out of collaborative will. So when I think, when I'm in symbolic consciousness, I have to understand that there's what's called the occult law of the forming of an organ. Because a lot of the language that's in The Alchemical Wedding comes from the alchemists who were physicians, they were chemists, they were pharmacologists, what we would call today. But they understood that the thing they were working on, the substance they were working on, was a substance, but it was also a metaphor. It was a metaphor for not only a natural process, but a processing consciousness. So salt was a substance, but was also a process, and it was also a consciousness. And they understood that if someone made a remedy for you, the consciousness of the person that made the memory was included in the substance that you were taking. And today, because machines make most of the substances that we take as medicaments, we have basically a machine consciousness in the medicines that we take, which has no morality, but because it has no morality, like in The Tempest, Prospero and Caliban, the elemental world can be used by any consciousness for positive or negative moral ends. Because there is no morality in the elemental world. There's only morality in human souls. Okay, so Paracelsus, the great Paracelsus, the physician, had a concept. He called it the archaeos. And the archaeos, we would call, in anthroposophical language, we would call it the life body or the ether body. He called it the star body. And he said that the body, the physical body, has behind it an archaeos, a star body, composed of forces that are held in the cosmos as what an alchemist would call the intelligence of the cosmos, or the intelligence of a planet, or the intelligence of a star, the consciousness of a pattern of form and rhythm that resulted in a substance. That's, we could call it archaeos. Patterns of forces, attraction and repulsion, osmosis and diffusion, convection, warmth rises, cold descends, and they organize in a cellular pattern. The things that are in the natural world where the forces are moving in a particular way create patterns that eventually become physical substances. We would say molecular bonding angles and stuff like that. Electron, proton, attraction, repulsion things. You know, what we have all these abstractions for. In the old days, we're actually beings. So the star body was a vehicle that a human had that allowed them to incarnate and receive forces from the cosmos that were intelligent. But it was like a template. Then in the template, or through the template, Paracelsus said there flowed what he called mumia. Mumia, we would say, that's the flowing of the forces in the life body. The archaeos is the structure of the forces of the life body. So the structure and the flowing are two sides of one coin, but they're not the same thing. And for him, an organ that was formed was being formed by the archaeos and then animated by the mumia. That's the occult law of organ formation. And so then if I take that organ out of an animal or a person, or I find an analog to it in the natural world, the mumia that is still flowing through it congeals, but the archaeos is still present for a certain amount of time until the organ atrophies to a point where it's no longer useful. This was the basis of healing in the old days, and it's the basis also of witchcraft in the old days. That's why it had to go into, go away. But that's the worldview that the alchemical wedding comes out of, and it's the worldview of things like homeopathic medicines and Bach flower remedies and body-mind connection and all these things that are part of the New Age coming up. It's just resurrecting that whole way of thinking. And in that way of thinking, there was what Paracelsus called the spagyric process. So these are spagyrics. So in spagyrics, it was understood that the human being had forces in them that were given to them by nature. The symbolic word for that is king. The king represents the lawfulness of the forces of the given. That's why the king was meant to be the dispenser of all the wealth in the kingdom, because he was the conduit that the given forces were choosing by divine right to have all the wealth circulate through the king as the given. So the king represents, as a symbolic idea, the archaeos, the form that the forces will flow through of the given, of, we could call it the ether body, the life body, of the sun, the ether body, the lawful given forces of nature. That, and the code word of that is king. That And if you know that, it makes reading this book a lot easier. So whenever they say king, they are saying, that's why, and bridegroom and all of that, the bridegroom is Christ. In the first day, if you read the first day, the bridegroom and the bride invite you to the wedding. The wedding is between the king and the queen. What's the queen? The queen is the soul that is doesn't have to go by the given. Because we all know the king may have his ideas, but the queen pillow talk, she's the, you know, that's, we all know how that works. If mama ain't happy, even the king ain't happy. So in the code language, queen always means the soul. And the soul is not given. The soul is free. The soul is the place where new life comes in that doesn't have to do with the king. I mean, it uses the king, but it's, you know, has its own potential. That's the soul. Because in the soul, a new embryo can be gestated that goes beyond the marriage. And the king can't do that. But the queen can do that. Cool language, huh? So in this book, the marriage is the marriage between the given forces of nature, which you have to deal with, and the not given forces of freedom in the soul. They have to marry each other. They have to be brought together in the soul. And when they do, there is an embryo that is created that is gestated in the womb of the great Sophia being, the Virgin. Our spirit embryo is gestated in the Immaculate, the womb of the Immaculate Conception. That's what that was about. It's about the who we will be in the future. And, you know, today, if you talk about that, it's like, well, what kind of betel nuts were you chewing, man? You're kind of whack. But that was a given worldview at that time. Of course, the reason why we're here is so that we can transcend and become supra-human. And was that was a given. Among people who understood things, among the people who were just, you know, drink your sixer of malt liquor and wake up under a bush. That's still happening. It will always happen. That's not a problem. But the ones who eventually that will get worked out, as they say, late and slow. But for those who want to accelerate the process, they have to actually consciously marry the soul to the laws of nature. This is just called getting sick. Getting sick is when your soul has to go, I think I better listen to the king. And then you get wise, maybe. Yeah, that's the picture. So the healing in this book is between the soul that has to marry the given. And out of that marriage comes the new, the virgin. That the virginal soul, the Sophia, the new embryo, the new human, the new Adam. They're all code words for the human being that has done the work of initiation. So that's why this is a text of initiation. It's in a symbolic text. It's called the Great Work. So in alchemy, the great work is you bringing natural will, the forces of the natural world, into marriage, into integrating them into soul. Carl Jung called it integration. Integration of the true self. Okay, so that's background. And then in this week, or in this weekend, what we're going to do is I've organized the daily round each day according to the alchemical principles of the marriage. So what we're going to do is in first period, we're going to work with something known as coagula. So the marriage always involves two polarities coming together, the wedding. And the two greatest polarities are salve, dissolving, and coagula, coagulation. Salve and coagula. So in salve, things that are formed become so dynamic that they start to dissolve and go away. They become more force-like. In coagula, things that are more force-like come through and actually become more like substance. And these are the two poles of coming into being or coming into manifestation or going out and dissolving into potential. So in the ancient world, the dissolving into nothing, it was not nothing, it was potential. It was seen as stronger, we could even say, than a stronger state of existence was when I had more potential. And when I came into manifestation, I was a sorry guest on this dark earth because I lost my potential. I became me in this incarnation rather than who I could be if I could be anybody I want. So go look in the eyes of a one-year-old and you see potential. And then go look in the eyes of most of our contemporaries and you see lost potential. Okay, so that process of going from potential to, oh, this is what I do, that's coagula. Quitting your job and doing crazy things is called salve. And you don't know where it's happening, but there you are, and you're kind of open to more possibilities than you were when you said, no, I got to go to work. Yeah? Those are the two poles in the soul of the same thing. So if I have an organ that's forming from forces, then it becomes an organ, and then it goes back out again, as the function of the organ is to dissolve stuff, then I have a breathing process between salve and coagula. This is the basis for most organic development. I either form a thing or I go into potential. So in our work, first period we'll do coagula. I'll lecture like this and then your head gets coagulated. Through cognition, we could say coagnition. Through stuff, through facts, through words. A word is a corpse of an idea. So first period will be salve, or coagula. Then is the great Mercury. And Mercury is the go-between between salve and coagula. Maybe I'll go to salve. So in our third period, we'll do dialogue. And dialogue is salve. Salve always means, if it goes back to potential, it means I've lost control of it. And the time you lose control over an idea is when you tell somebody else what you think. And then you've just spoken what you think into a whole other universe. And then they say what they think, and you realize, whoa, that's salve. So in dialogue is a practice of saying something in coagula and then letting it go into the salve of uncertainty. And what you begin to see is the nature of the will. So all through the story, there are set points where Christian Rosenkreuz is having dialogue with particular people. or beings. I've chosen a couple of them to serve as dialogue talking points. We'll go into more of a seminar form, and we'll sit in more of a circle in third period every day. I will bring the theme of the day, which is one of them is just off the top of my head, is making a mistake evil. That's our talking point. And I'll set the stage and we'll go and I'll try to give you some rules of engagement for dialogue. We'll do dyads first, then we'll do smaller groups, and then we'll open it up and we'll see if we can't get a feeling for what is it like to actually track something that I can't control. How can I watch an idea move? When we first did Koros 10 years ago, the whole focus of the whole Koros Institute was just that. Remember those first couple ones? We'd just sit around here and we'd have something as a dialogue, and all we did was have different levels of dialogue between two people and four people and come back and silence. And it drove people crazy, so we had to do other things. But I'll bring it back again as an idea in third period. So I'll give you rules of engagement, but that will be our salve. So salve is listening to someone say something you totally disagree with, but being able to allow them to say it without thinking nasty things. That's salve. So Aristotle, is a wonderful quote from Aristotle, is it's the wise person who can entertain a thought without believing it. That's dialogue. Okay, and in between, then we have Mercury. Mercury is the go-between between salve and coagula, between cognition and this kind of general, what's the will of the group, we could call that third period almost committee work, is the feeling life, Mercury. And what I'd like to do with you in the Mercury part is I've been working for a couple of years now with collage work, making collage. And I have chosen some thematic elements for the collage that we'll be working, and you'll work in dyads with another person, to illustrate some of the tension in the dialogue that we'll choose for that day. So artistically, we'll be using symbolic pictures, and then you'll share them with a partner, and they'll get a chance to change them around to see if you can illustrate with a picture the dialogue that Christian Rosenkreutz is going through with the being that he's speaking to in that particular situation, and then share that with a partner and have them ask you questions about it. And what that does is it brings up feelings. And then we'll use that in the evening. I will, if for, let's see, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we'll have an art show, last one, of the pictures and some of the collages that we do. But Thursday and Friday, for the evening session, what I want to do with you is a fun thing. I call it a design clinic. We'll look at how does a triangle talk to a circle? This is where we get the tiny Alice, and we'll play some kind of fun games with squares and triangles and forms and shapes and colors, just with scissors and arranging paper. And then we'll talk about what we see, because it's in those arrangements that you can find some of the deepest laws of the soul as far as feelings go. Is a red circle in the top of a square different than a red circle in the bottom of a square? And if you say no, then you're going to have fun in design clinic. Okay, so that's, so thinking, feeling, willing. Sal, Mercury, self. So each day we'll do that, and then you'll work with Pam. We've talked. You'll, in the afternoons, you'll paint, and she's going to reiterate the themes of here's a wash where it flows, that's solve. Here's a wash where I form an edge, that's coagula. So artistically, you'll be working with color and form in the afternoons to do exactly the same thing we do in the mornings. It's kind of boot camp for your soul. In the process of initiation, according to Christian Rosenkreutz. Okay, so that's the outline of the day. And I'd like to go to these ideas of spagyrics and use it to give a picture out of the first day of the alchemical wedding. So Christian Rosenkreutz is performing a ritual at Easter time, and he realizes that he hears a sound behind him, but he's in his room alone. And he becomes aware of a presence behind him and is afraid to turn around, and then finally turns around and sees an angel with huge wings with eyes all over them, and all the eyes are looking at him. Well, that's kind of an interesting thing to experience, and the angel hands him an invitation to a wedding. And he realizes in the process that he has been actually preparing inwardly for this wedding for a long time. There's something that's going on in him that has this recognition, and the recognition makes him very excited and very, very afraid at the same time. He's inflating because he's going to the wedding, and he's having a kind of, but the way he solves it is he goes to sleep. Now, in this book, going to sleep is a code word. It just means altered consciousness. So when he says, I went to sleep, and here he goes to sleep because he's freaked out about seeing an angel with whose wings are filled with eyes, giving him, asking him to come to a wedding. And the invitation is not, oh, come, we'll have a party. It's like, you better like get in line, dude, because this is a big deal. And then it's signed by the bridegroom and the bride, and it says, you know, this comes from, and basically it's like, this comes from this one official presidential deal, and this is for you, and you better pay attention. So he's freaked out, so he decides to go to sleep. And when he goes to sleep, he has a dream. So as you're going through the book, it's very good to pay attention to what he dreams, because the dreaming is a Rosicrucian method for doing a spagyric. We have to include dreaming. We have to purify dreaming. We have to stabilize it. We have to move it away from simply maintenance of the organism. We have to move it from that into a dialogue. And only we can do that. And only we can know whether we've done that or not. And that, we could say, is the nature of the great work of the wedding. Now, in order to do that, in order to go into the dream, when he goes into the dream, he dreams he's in a cavern. He's in a prison. This is called having a body. And in the prison, there are all these inmates in there, and there's a rope hanging down through a hole in the ceiling, and they're all clawing at each other to get the rope, because every once in a while, a door opens in the top, and the rope gets pulled up, and whoever's hanging on the rope goes up and gets out of the prison, and everybody else is left back there in the prison. That's his dream. And he realizes out of the dream that there's not a lot of time left for the rope to go up and down. But it really bothers him that watching all these humans bang on each other. Really, it just something in it does is just says, I don't care if this is the way out of here. I don't want to participate in this. So he finds a little rock on the side, and he's sitting there watching. The rope comes down, everybody punching each other to get on the rope, and then they pull each other off, and then finally a couple of people are hanging, goes up, and he said, this is something not right here about this. And then he realizes that sitting on his rock, the rope goes down in the center of the dungeon, the prison, and that he's, by sitting on the rock, basically he's moved himself out of the action. So there's no way for him to get out of the prison because he's decided to go and be an observer of this dog-eat-dog world, the rat-eat-rat race. And so he's caught between, should I go down and just start punching people or whatever? And the rope comes down, and there's a big battle because there's a guy up in the top and says, there's only a couple more times you're going to let the rope down, and you better, you know. So it's really getting kind of wild. And in the struggle down below, someone whacks the rope, and it moves around and comes by his perch. And he jumps and grabs the rope, gets pulled up, and he gets wounded when he gets pulled up, and then he's bleeding, but he's so glad at being pulled up, he grabs the rope and starts pulling up, trying to help other people come up. And when he gets up above, he's in another world, and in the other world, there's a great matron and her old son. And they represent this other world of the dream where you go and the beings on the other side, they are, in the language of the kahunas, they're known as the almakua, the person who will never lie to you. And they speak a kind of language about the reality of the other side. That it's not personal that people are in the dungeon. And the matron says, it pains me to have to do this, but it was written long before I got this job that this is the way it's supposed to happen. And we are simply enacting the great will. And basically, bear your wound for me. That's what she says to him. And that's the end of the first day of the dream. That's a very strange dream. But it's my experience after working with this book for a long while that every time he dreams, he's actually going through his own body. He's going through, penetrating through the given to say, where is it here that what's the issue here? How can I get out of the dungeon? How can I get out of the dungeon of my body where I come in and I have to have hip replacements and whatever? How can I mean, I could become bionic That's one way. But there are other things I've been reading now about the metal on metal produces cobalt, and the cobalt is now seeping through people's systems. It comes out of the metal on metal hip replacement. And so there's all these lawsuits now about hip replacement because of metal toxicity. Yeah, so there's just these repercussions of everything we do. We could call it karma. So in the work of initiation, in being in the dungeon, I have to awaken in the dream and realize that I, when I'm dreaming and when I'm awake. And eventually that plays over into my waking life, because in my waking life I begin to experience when I'm dreaming. And in my dreaming I begin to experience when I'm awake. And in my awake, I begin to experience when I'm dreaming. Now, it turns out that I do most of my not-so-wonderful stuff in this side in a dream state. That's chocolate cake, we could say. Is the great dream state here. All our appetites, all our desires, all of that is a dreaming. And the goal of initiation is to be awake here on this side when I start to dream. If I'm awake when I start to dream, I can put another dream in there and block the dream that the beings on the other side want me to dream. This is called initiation science. But in order to do that, I have to take my thinking and my feeling and my willing apart. I have to will my thinking and have to think into my will. I have to set them in a way against each other, and that is, in the esoteric language or in the language of alchemy, that's called spagyric. So, so if I want to make a medicine, I take a plant. If I want to make a spagyric medicine, I take a plant, I burn the plant, I take the ash from the plant and put it in water, I let it sit for a while, and the water draws the salt out of the plant that the plant used to attract the water for its growth. I purify the salt and I have salt, salt. Before I burn the plant, I want to boil it and take out the oil. That's the sulfur. I have an oil, I have a salt, and then I take what's left over, I put it in water, I make alcohol out of it. Alcohol's the mercury. Those three, mercury, salt, sulfur of a plant, are broken apart chemically or in a laboratory, and then I purify each one. It's a long process, and then I bring them back together again, and that's called the alchemical wedding. Now, when I do that with my soul, I have to break the salt part of me off from the sulfur part of me. I have to break the habitual thinking where my will is locked in a lockstep way to my thinking. I have to separate them. And when I do, I start to see the impossibility of trying to separate them. This is called changing a habit. I can think, I don't want to do this anymore, and then I watch myself do it. Yeah, but I don't want to do this anymore. Right. Okay, thank you for sharing, but go do it. You know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? So whose will is that? It's not ours. It's been grandfathered into another will structure. And in order to resurrect it from that will structure, I have to make a spagyric of my own soul. I have to separate my thinking and my will. So there are a couple very important ideas in this. And that is, I have to ask myself, in myself, what in my soul is salve? What in my soul is the dissolving nature? We could call salve surrender. What can I afford to surrender to? How much of my life is surrender? Well, the opposite pole is coagula, which is, hell no, I won't go. I think this, and this is the way it is. It's coagula. Whether it's in my thinking or in my will, I could be stubborn, I could be fixed ideas, whatever, all of that is coagula. So I take an inventory in myself of what in my soul is salve and coagula, and I try to salve my coagula and coagulate my salve. And when I do, what comes up is my feelings in the middle, the mercury, that keeps the thing going. So that leads me to the next quality, is the mercury is rhythm. So I pay attention to the timing of my salve and coagula rather than the blaming of my salve and coagula. I watch my salve and coagula as if I was watching somebody else do salve and coagula. And I just note the timing of things. Hour, day, week, month, year of the great whatever that I want to look at. I look at it as a time thing, because hidden in it is a rhythm that over time has given it strength to not do what I would will. So if I wish to unravel it, I have to unravel it in time and watch time. So Rudolf Steiner's great mantra is rhythm replaces strength, or rhythm replaces power. I need to be an expert in rhythm. Now, the greatest rhythm, the most profound change in rhythm in my daily life is waking up and going to sleep. The shift in consciousness between day consciousness, awake consciousness, and sleep consciousness is the most huge shift in consciousness that the human goes through in their life. So paying attention to the rhythms around sleeping and waking gives me a door into the dreaming, so I can watch the tick-tock of my feelings as they happen, as I start to dream during the day. If I pay attention to going asleep and waking up, I start to see during the day when I go to sleep and when I wake up. I start to be aware of it. Prior to that, it's just, who knows what? It's 10 o'clock, do you know where your head is, you know? So the Rosicrucians and the work in alchemy, it was often said, it's more important to pay attention to when you do something than what you do. There's a kind of rhythmic structure in the becoming of the thing that is perceptible if I wish to see how the thing came into being. This includes issues in my own life. I have to see how the issue comes into being in time. Once I do, I start to build in my soul a tolerance for my misunderstanding, which is the healing. I can watch myself misunderstand and do. That's why one of our questions is making a mistake evil? There are all these things in the public domain today. If you go kill somebody or take their life savings away, you'll maybe go to prison a little bit, but you'll be a celebrity. Go and have a liaison with some babe on the side and you're dead meat. Yeah, or whatever. I mean, I don't want to get political or whatever, but we're very confused about what is evil and what is stupid. And we treat what is stupid as evil and what is evil as stupid. And it's, you know, we're going to hell in a handbasket as a result of it. So there's plenty of stupid things, very few evil things, but there's this kind of realm in there of the dreaming, where if we become aware of dreaming in the day, we see there are certain doorways, low blood sugar, glycemic thresholds, where suddenly, ooh, yeah, I'm doing something that I said I wasn't going to do, but I'm doing it anyway, you know. Da, 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 da. There are all these rhythms. And if I learn to pay attention to rhythms, it replaces the strength of having to power through everything. This includes, then, placing things consciously into sleep, which is collaborative will. So in The Alchemical Wedding, Christian Rosenkreutz is dreaming and waking and dreaming and waking in collaboration with all these beings on the other side who are teaching him all these things and leading him through processes where he has to face symbols of his own misunderstanding. Lions, and there's plays within the play of really dark, you know, things happening to people, and then they come back around. These are all images of inner states of consciousness that the beings who are trying to educate him in the initiation process are giving to him as dream pictures and metaphors of the things he needs to face. That's what the book's about. So all the, whether it's a lion or a bird or a snake or somebody getting beheaded or whatever, it's not here. Being beheaded here is, you know, murder. Being beheaded over there means that you learn how to stop your sensory processes so that you can think pure thoughts. Basically, you just chop off your head. So people don't know that, they read the book, they go, oh God, this is disgusting. Here, yes. There, metaphor, hello. It's a metaphor. It's a symbol of something. And then the blood, oh, what the blood? The blood is where the house where the ego lives. The I-being is living. So that's, it's all fed to the dead ones so that they can, their consciousness can awaken fully on the other side. Basically, that's what it's about. Can I awaken fully over there? Well, you have to chop off your head. Yeah, stop thinking those kind of thoughts and participate in the drama. So the doorway to do that is I have to place seed thoughts into the other side regularly with will from this side, place them in through the dream portal, they go in and they become beings on the other side that then teach me, and then I wake up here and I'm led in the world to things that I didn't realize I was dreaming, but they come to me on this side as insight and creative activity. Wow. And I don't realize that I'm collaborating. And when I collaborate, I get synergy. I get a kind of afterburner to my thinking process and my imagination and my will. I place things over there, things come back, and then in my daily life, I have another sense that I build in my heart that becomes aware that this thing that I'm doing now has more levels than one. That's a kind of radar. But I have to build that from this side. If I wait for it to happen, good luck. It'll happen, but there'll be collateral damage all the way through. And so the difference between collateral damage and self-inflicted damage that I inflict myself is when I do this work myself, I'm eating my own shadow. I am, rather than having somebody serve it up on a plate to me. So when that happens, I become aware. If I start working with sleep and wake and sleep and wake and sleep and wake, I start to experience collaborative will. I can look for what we could call a self-adjusting process. I have the faith that when I begin a process and it starts to work, that when it is time for that thing to happen, it will happen, even though I don't know how it's going to happen. I know that I do not know, but I also know that when I need to know, I will know. That's collaborative will that leads to a perception of a self-adjusting process. I understand that the other side is a coefficient of my activity here. It's a vector. I vector out and it vectors back. And over time, I recognize how the vector is moving in time. Time becomes plastic. I can stretch it and squish it to get stuff done that I need to get done, because I'm not freaking out about the stuff that's not getting done, because maybe it just doesn't need to get done. I've already received the input that will be there, so let's not freak out about it. Let's do this over here. Okay, I do this. And then when it tracks, I go, okay, here it comes. Usually in my case, when the download starts, I can feel a change in my heartbeat, or I become very aware of my heartbeat. That lets me know you've got mail. You know, pay attention, you'll be all right, you got mail, just go in and do it. Okay, well, if that doesn't happen, then I'm kind of wondering. So these four, this is a spajarik of taking the soul apart, separating out my, in order for me to take an idea into sleep, I have to be able to form a picture, move it forwards and backwards, and dissolve it. That's a very different kind of will than, you know, mowing the lawn. When I mow the lawn, I expect that the lawn will be mowed. I mean, hello. But when I do that, there's no download. When I take a picture in, there's nothing. And then I wake up and I listen, it's silence, there's nothing either. But the letting go allows the letting come, if you know the you language. But it can go even deeper. We can structure the relationship between the letting go and the letting come. That's what we could call sacred sleeping. Okay, I take into sleep pictures that I wish to work with. And they begin to speak to me. Okay, so over time, the spajarik process, the self-adjusting process, leads to journal keeping and making observations that become very, very fine about my own inner life in the context of my outer life. I see the thread and connections start to happen in big chunks of things, and other people will go, man, your head is like crazier than a pet coon, you know? It's like I can't follow. You're over here, and you're over there, and you're over there, and you're over there. And I'm, yeah, right. If you learn how to do this, they're all going in time with each other. They're all feeding each other. You just have to have the faith that you're being guided. And if you do, Rudolf Steiner calls that inspiration. So the forming and dissolving of the picture, Rudolf Steiner calls that imagination, with a capital I, imagination. So when I start the process of imagination, of forming and dissolving pictures that I wish to work with, when I do that, I start, and I take them into sleep, I start a rhythmic flow back and forth between myself and some form of benefactor. Yes?
So the inspiration that allows, that moves you to act, that you don't want to judge, you know, have it be something that you're blaming yourself for, could it be something that doesn't feel good, but yet the outcome on the other side of it is like, wow.
Yeah, you can't actually control the outcome.
Right. Well, it's not a desire to control the outcome.
So Rudolf Steiner gives an indication. He said that this work that I'm describing to you is done by paying attention to small things. It's not the big ticket items that get the work done. It's the everyday small things that you do that are actually reinforcing the patterns again and again and again. And it's in those daily little reinforcements that I want to start waking up. So all the time in the alchemical wedding, the virgins just putting Krishna Rosenkreutz down, you know, you don't get it, you're an old horny guy, blah, blah, blah. And he's going, but no, I'm not. And she's constantly kind of knocking him back a little bit. The knocking oneself, and she's knocking him back because she represents his purified soul. And she's saying to him, I'm going to knock you back and watch what happens. So she knocks him back, and instead of going, if it was from New Jersey, he'd, you know, pull out some heat and they'd be down the road. But he cries. She knocks back, he cries. That's called the gift of tears. And that is, I understand that I don't understand. The biggest inflation is thinking that your glasses are your glasses. It's a huge inflation, because they weren't yours until you installed them. And if you forgot them and somebody else picked them up, well, then they wouldn't be yours anymore. So we attach to things very naturally, and it's in that attaching to things that is hidden all the energy of the synergy that we need to explore and open up, because it's locked. So I'll give you something to take into sleep. Okay? So we can play this. So tomorrow, one of Krishna Rosenkreutz's great flaws is that he is curious about knowledge. He's deeply attracted to knowledge. And books and little gizmos and all of this. It's a little flaw that he has. And they play it up really big because it kind of trips him up down the road. But all these little kind of esoteric globes and toys and books with funny writing in it, and, you know, it's kind of like Narnia stuff. That's one of his flaws. It's called curiosity. In him, it's very innocent. But every time he does it, the virgin kind of tweaks his nose about stuff, because she's trying to say this, you need to kind of look at this. So one of our, as a human, one of our biggest inflationary issues is what we could call my space. You are in my space. This is my space. It comes from having my body. And I grandfather in the stuff around me because my body's here, my space is here, and I carry my space around with me. And when I live at home, my space expands. When you come into my space, this is my space. I may even have the my space in my space. It's like you don't go in here or you die. Yeah? That process we call ensouling. So a very simple exercise is to pay attention to how much space you need when you talk to somebody. So I can talk like this, and I'm talking and I'm a lecturer, and it expects that my voice at this level, I should use my voice at this level because I'm lecturing in a room. But as I start to come into your space with this level of voice, you start to feel
like I want to move away.
Like you want to move away because I am pushing my space into your space. Can you feel that? That is so fundamental. It's a little thing. But it's a little thing that happens again and again and again and again. And certain people you make deals with can be in your space in another way. And then, okay, now don't get in my space. So some of you, you wake up in the morning and before coffee, your space is about 10 feet out. And then after coffee, it's maybe a foot out. Because it's okay, but don't come into my space until I've had my coffee, because coffee allows me to go, do a coagula. Okay, I'm coagulated. You can, whatever you want to bring is going to bounce off of my coagulation. And we're okay with that. Okay, because you bring coagula to me, you want to see coagula? I got some coagula for you. Can you feel it? Rather than solving, oh, yes, come on, you can do whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm Mother Teresa. It's okay. No. Okay, can you feel it? That is an example of what I mean, a little thing that you take into sleep. So tomorrow we're going to do a collage work. I'll tell you what we'll do. The collage will be. The collage will be juxtapose two symbols that gain symbolic importance through contrast of space relationships. So you take a magazine, you cut out a coyote and a whale, and you play with them. Or a parachute guy, or I don't know, you know, whatever. If you came to this workshop, I consider you probably have a strange imagination going on anyway, so don't worry about it. And you'll juxtapose those two things and change their space and then write about it. That's our exercise for tomorrow, the collage work that'll be in second period, to prepare for that. So now we're actually going to do the alchemical wedding. To prepare for that tonight, I would like you to pick a situation in your life where you felt this space thing. Maybe you live on a farm with 37 relatives. And your space is impacted by that as soon as you get 10 miles away from the place where you live. Find out where the edge of the aura of the family is in your locale. As a feeling, picture yourself on this side of that, going to the edge, and go inside of that. Maybe the front gate. Maybe it's the pathway to the latrine. I don't know, you know, whatever. But there's some place where there's a threshold where your space, you have this thing. Think about it a little bit tonight and then make a movie of it. The movie is, I'm outside and then I get near, okay, and then back out again. Play in and out of the space where you feel that. Maybe you had an IRS thing years ago, and every time you go to work, you drive by downtown, by the IRS place where you were audited. Well, guess what? Your body knows that. And your feelings know that. And every time you go by, you go, okay. That is the source of later things that say, that's a compression, that's a coagula. I'm going to have to get a Solve for that. And whatever that is, that Solve is connected to that thing. And if it happens all the time, then you have chronic coagula or whatever, it just becomes atherosclerosis, and you know, So this book is about modern people living modern lives, having to deal with inflation and skepticism, with expansion and contraction of their financial situation even as we speak, or whatever, the uncertainty of life. How can I find certainty in the uncertainty? I can't find it because it's not part of the given. Part of the given is just what the king knows. I have to get the queen to marry the king. So I have to get my soul to go into my own life forces, into my own archaeos, my own solar body, and say, how is this operating in you? Especially with small things, because there you get a door into perception of the way in which your soul is responding to this in myriad ways. This is not just a one-time thing. It's the small things. So we'll look at space, we'll look at time, because the dream, time and space, gets kind of whack. But if you can learn to think into the dream and we get stable there, time and space kind of change over here. Things look different about time and space. You can get things done in a different way. And I think that's the value of this book, the teaching, is that it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay. It's part of the learning process. What's not okay is to inflate. You could say the cardinal problem is inflation. The cardinal problem is believing that I am greater than I really am. So the healing of it is humility. Doesn't mean you have to be a doormat. Nope, doesn't mean that at all. It just means you have to understand. Humility means I understand that I don't understand. And if I can say that to myself and I made a mistake, I kind of, you know, athletes, even though it gets kind of tacky sometimes, they have this rule, just move beyond it. Because they're performers in the public eye, having to do all these incredible weird things night after night after night. And if they start really going in and getting the cat of nine tails out because they missed 10 shots last night, you know what a coach would say to a basketball player that missed 15 shots one night? You know what they would say to them the next night? I want you to shoot more. I want you to shoot more. Why would they say, I want you to shoot more? Because they don't want a crippled basketball player emotionally. Go blow it out. Blow through it. Make a lot of mistakes. And you'll come around. When Rudolf Steiner was in his later years, bunch of young people came to him and they said, we don't like the way these old people are doing these rituals, and we don't like all the rules they have in the branch, and we don't like all this kind of weird stuff they're always uptown and us and everything. And he said, okay, you don't like the rituals? Make your own. And the story goes, Marie Steiner went, what are you doing? These are young people, they don't know what they're doing. And he said, they will be corrected. So we are receiving tremendous forces from the spiritual world all the time to correct things. We call it bad luck, usually. Or petty tyrants, or stupid colleagues, or whatever. And all of that is true. However, on the other side, it's being put into our begging bowl so that we can get certain forces to go to the next level. That's the picture that Krishna Rosenkreuz has to continually go through in the alchemical wedding. And he does it with humility. So I believe that's, for me, that's the message. So find a feeling of space where you can actually say, oh yeah, you know, this, I don't like it when, and then run the scenario before, in, after, forwards and backwards, and that'll be a seed that of coagulin salve that you will put into a rhythmic nature of your sleep. The collaborative will of your benefactor on the other side will take that and give you synergy tomorrow for the self-digesting process that we'll do in our collage work. So have good dreams.